When I was a youth minister a long, long time ago, I had a deacon come to me after church and yell at me. Traumatized me to this day. What was happening is we had this program where we took the teens to the hospitals every Sunday afternoon to visit the people that were sick of our church. And we had a lot of people that were sick of our church. It was an older church. It was a large church. So there's always somebody in the five or six hospitals that there were in Memphis. And so we would go to each one of the hospitals and visit whoever our members were there. Well, there were more hospitals to visit than there were chaperones to help us get the teens there. And so for a while, some of the older teens drove. And that caused some chaperone problems. In other words, the kids were going wild because they weren't being supervised. And so the elders asked us to kind of step away from that program for a while until we could get it a little bit better supervised. Well, this deacon comes storming up to me after church, after that was announced, and just all angrified at me because the elders decided to stop that program. He was the deacon in charge of young people. I had no idea who this guy was. I had not seen him in a year and a half, and he was supposed to be part of our program. And he said, you know, so I did exactly what I always do when somebody's angry. I threw the elders under the bus. I said, you know, the elders decided to do that. That was their decision. And he said, they can't do that without consulting me first. That's what I thought. I was a little bit startled that he was talking, because, you know, his idea was the elders have got to go through me because I'm the deacon. And I wanted to say, well, get the deacon. You know, you've got a car and you're off on Sunday afternoons. Why can't you help us chaperone? We've been trying to find somebody to help us and nobody did. So we had to stop the program. You see, his idea was that being a deacon meant that he was part of the power chain, part of the chain of command of the church, rather than being a worker in it. And I think that's a position that a lot of us have. It sometimes seems that deacons are part of the official, the names on the letterhead, you know, elders and deacons, and sometimes list them, that they're part of church leadership. Paul says in Philippians 1 and verse 1, as he's addressing the letter to Philippi, he says, to all of God's holy people in Christ Jesus at Philippi, together with overseers and deacons. Well, the word overseers, episkopos, is the word for bishop. So that kind of sounds like power chain stuff. I mean, how are you going to get higher in a church than a bishop, for crying out loud? And so maybe overseers and deacons, bishops and deacons, means the deacons are part of that power chain. You know the way that the power chain in the church goes, right? There's elders, and there's deacons, and there's members. And then there's preachers, because they're the only one in that group you can fire. Yeah. Well, the word deacon has nothing to do with power chain. That's the reason we don't let women be deacons, right? Because they can't be part of the power chain unless you, like, read the Bible. Romans chapter 16 and verse 1. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church in Cenchrea. Now, I'm not going to talk about women and being deacons. That's a windmill we can joust with another day. What we're talking about today is deacon, and the point that I'm making is that nowhere in the word deacon does that have anything to do with chain of command or power chain in the church. It's not about hierarchy. It's about service. The word diakonos, which is translated deacon or transliterated, really, deacon, is defined in the lexicon like this. First definition, to wait on tables. Second definition, to care for. And third definition, more generally, to serve. The word deacon is about serving. Now, I don't mean serving in the idea of public service. In Luke chapter 1, verse 23, when his time of service, talk about Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, when his time of service was completed, he was a priest, and they only served in he was only on duty part of the time. And so when he was off duty, then the rest of the things in the story are going to happen. That word service, which sort of means role, responsibility, office, that's a whole different Greek word. That is not the same word that we're talking about. The word that's used for deacon is like butler Downton Abbey fans, you know, they would ring the bell and the butler would just show up. You rang? That's the word diakonos in the New Testament. In John 12 and verse 2, here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha deaconed. It's the verb form of deacon. She was the she was the butler. She served. And while Lazarus was among those reclining. See, that's the biblical form. The guys recline and watch the ball game, and the women are supposed to be, you know, fetch and serve, right? Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be, but sadly, that's sometimes the way that it is. But that shows what the word means, right? Matthew 22 and verse 13, the king told his attendants, in some translations, that servants. Well, the servant there is not a position. It is a, these are the slaves, the servants that are around for him to call to do his bidding. In fact, Paul is going to use this very same word to get away from status and position. You know, there was people in the church at Corinth that thought he had hung the moon, and others thought Apollos had hung the moon. And so Paul writes in verse 3, after all, what after all is Apollos, and what is Paul? Only deacons, servants. See, that's not status. He's saying all we are, don't line up and become part of our party. You're supposed to be serving Christ. We're only helping in that. We're only serving in that regard. In fact, Jesus says that being a servant is the antithesis of being in charge. He talks about the rulers of the Gentiles, and he talks about how they exert authority and exercise dominion. And he says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your deacon. Same word in the original. Deacon is servant. It is someone who serves. It is a word of not command, but a word of putting yourself on the line, serving other people. We continue today with our ongoing study that we're calling the Restoration Revisited. Our heritage in Churches of Christ is from a 18th century, to actually early 19th century, restoration movement, a unity movement in reality that tried to unite all believers in Christ Jesus. And the way to do that is you go behind the traditions and behind the creeds and go back to the Bible. And so we wanted to do, as we've been saying, do Bible things in Bible ways, but we couldn't exactly agree on all those things. We focused on formats, and we tried, okay, you got to do communion right, you got to do baptism right, you got to do church organization right. And we couldn't agree on those things, and so eventually we fought and fractured, and that a unity aspect was lost. But what we've been suggesting in this series is, what if restoration was not about discovering New Testament formats, but rather restoring the power and the passion of that first church to do Bible things in the way that God would have us to do them today, to be captured by the same things that that first church was captured by. And so we've been going back to Acts and looking at a few things that relate to that. Well, today the question is this. What if we just made everyone a deacon? That everybody here today was appointed deacon of the church. I know what some of you think. Doesn't it say somewhere in the New Testament about deacons and wine? I'm not sure I could go in for being a deacon if I'd have to give that up. No, no, that's not what you're thinking. You're thinking of, no, everybody can't be a deacon. Because if everybody was a chief, where would the Indians be? Well, see, that's the point we're making. That being a deacon is about serving other people. It's about being the butler that's waiting for the ring to call, the bell to ring, so I can jump in and do the service. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Just keep that question in the back of your mind. We're going to be looking at Acts chapter 6 very briefly as we begin. In Acts 6, there was the first bump in the road. Everything up to this was the church growth gone wild. You know, the church was growing and expanding, and Luke gives us all of these. You know, they were 3,000, and then there were 5,000, and then there was a great multitude of people that are believing. They go through a period of persecution in chapter 3 and chapter 4 and chapter 5, but that's not going to stop them. What almost stops them is the mass confusion that takes place when you grow that fast. One of the things the church was known for is was doing good. They had the favor of all the people because there were no poor among them, but they were taking care of one another's needs. That's stressed three times in the opening chapters of Acts 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the problem was, by the time we get to chapter 6, is that there were some that either were being overlooked and having their needs taken care of, or the perception was this group was being neglected. The Grecian Jews, or the Greek-speaking Jews, depending on your translation, these were women who were widows that were from out of town. They had traveled for Pentecost, had been converted, and now they're without, even more poor than they were before. And so food was being passed out to everyone else. Food was passed out to the local widows, but some, it was thought, were being overlooked. And so that's kind of the background of what we're going to do as our scripture reading this morning from Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through.
Well, as the believers rapidly multiplied, there were rumblings of discontent. The Greek-speaking believers complained about Hebrew-speaking believers, saying that their widows were being discriminated against in the daily distribution of food. So the 12 called a meeting of all believers. They said, "We apostles should spend our time teaching the word of God, not running a food program. And so brothers, select 7 men who are all well-respected and are full of the spirit and wisdom. We will give them this responsibility. Then we apostles can spend our time in prayer and teaching the word."
Okay. The apostles, as the leaders of the church at Jerusalem, jump in to kind of solve this problem. They recognize, first of all, that was a problem, and they immediately say, okay, we need, these guys are the ones that are chosen to do this work of meeting the needs of the widows are traditionally referred to as the first deacons. And they're never called deacons, but the apostles say it would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of the word in order to wait on tables. And that's the word for deacon. So they're never called deacons, but the work that they're called to do is that of deacons. And if you look at the people that are actually chosen, Philip and Procurius and Nicanor and Timon and Parmenas and Nicholas, those guys, almost all of them, have in common the fact those are Greek names. So that sets a standard. Talk about a pattern for the church. How's that for a pattern? The leaders of the Jerusalem church acted quickly, and they acted wisely. How much better when somebody says, something needs to be done, they appointed them in charge of doing the thing that needed to be done. And so now everybody sees that. That's a great idea. And now we've got people in charge. The chaos has, order has come, and the people that are being overlooked are not being overlooked anymore. And then immediately, by the time we get to verse 7, it's back to, and the church grew in number. Now, we ask, what if everyone was made a deacon? And it's obviously here, not everybody was made a deacon. There weren't, 5,000 plus deacons appointed. There was only 7. In fact, one of the things that happens in verse 6 is that when they were chosen, the elders laid their hands on them, and it was like an official ordaining. So not only are they chosen, they were ordained. And then 1 Timothy 3, when Paul gets to telling Timothy, okay, now when you select deacons, he gives him a special qualities or characteristics. Sometimes we call them qualifications that deacons must. And if you compare the qualities or qualifications of deacons with the qualities and qualification of elders, you can argue that the ones for the deacons are even more stringent than the ones for elders. So if we're having this idea that everybody's a deacon, why were only a few chosen, and why have all of these qualifications? Well, think about it. When the deacon is doing his job out in the community, and particularly those that were in Acts 6 that were appointed to distribute food, that they would be like official representatives of the church. So Paul is saying, make sure that when you send people out, that they're worthy of being your representative and the representative of your church. I mean, that's the reason there's so much turmoil in Richmond in the last week and a half, right? We're wondering whether the people that we've selected are really good representations of the people of the Commonwealth. And so Paul does give qualities or qualifications for these special people that are chosen as deacons. But remember, these deacons are not chosen to lead the church. They're chosen to serve the church. Okay. In this list of qualities or qualifications, there's this interesting statement made in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 10. They, meaning these people that are chosen as deacons, must first be tested. And then if nothing's against them, let them serve as deacons. That's the NIV. And I think we've gotten a false idea about what church leadership is about because we were misled by the translation in the King James that was perfect in its day, but kind of changed its meaning. In the King James, it says the office of deacon. Well, what is office? That sounds like it's an official church office. You know, Hayward's wondering where his office is. I mean, he's at the building every day. He could have an office if there's supposed to be an office of deacon. But that verse doesn't say anything about an office. Literally, what it says is, if there is nothing against them, let them deek. Let them work as a deacon. It's not about an office. It's about service. Think about it. Paul has this idea that people are to be serving, being tested, and then when they're seen to be qualified in their service, then let them serve officially as a deacon. Now, when we normally appoint deacons, how do we do it? Or how have churches that you've been a part of? Well, the way it usually works is like this. The elders say, you know, we need more deacons in our church. So make a list of men that you think are qualified to be deacons, and then turn them in by such and such a date. And a committee or we as the elders will go over that and make sure these guys are qualified. And usually what that means is you count wives and count children. If they have more than one wife or less than one child, then they're not qualified because it talks about being a husband and being a parent. And then we'll appoint them. Well, then you got to find them some job to do. And so you look at the jobs that are available in church and you plug one of those deacons into it, regardless of whether he has any interest in that or whether he has any spiritual gift that allows him to be capable in that. We had a guy years ago, I'll call him John, mainly because that was his name, that we elected deacon, and he was a great Christian man, still is. And well, we looked at the organizational chart, and there was a hole on the organizational chart for women's ministries. One of the ladies in the church had got this organized ministry going that was done by the ladies, and there was several, you know, things that, you know, making food for people that are sick, and there was like four different things that fell into that, and so they made John the deacon in charge of women's studies, and his job was essentially taking a written report from the lady that was really doing the program and then reading that report at the elders and deacons meeting. That's silly, isn't it? I mean, you find people that are deacons, and then you recognize them as deacons. That's what Paul is saying there. And being a deacon is not part of the power chain of the church. It's to emphasize the service of the church. I think this hierarchical view of church, seeing the church as this specific organization with the organizational chart, I think that's hurting our view of what the church really is. I mean, the elders and, you know, they're the ones that make all the decisions. And so if you want something, you know, permission to do something, you go to the elders. And then the deacons are the one that manages it. So you go to, okay, I want to be involved in helping with the building, so I go to the deacons in charge of that, and he will give me. And then, of course, the preacher, he's the one that's to blame for everything that goes wrong. At least that's the way we sometimes act. The church is not an organization. It's a family. It's a body where every part is supposed to be doing its part. I like the way Tom Rainier But Tom Rainier just retired not too long ago as CEO of Lifeway Incorporated, the big Baptist bookstore. But his main job was doing church growth research, and he does a lot of writing about that. And he wrote this article entitled, Why People Leave the Church. And he starts out by saying, yeah, you know, there are a lot of good reasons why people leave the church. A church, like, you know, there's something evil being done, and you try to fix it, and you can't fix it, so you don't have to. Sometimes that, and then there's, you know, every church has its own personality, and sometimes yours doesn't match up, and after a while of struggle, you know, there are good reasons. But he said, you know what the number one reason is why most people leave one church to go to another one? I'm not talking about moving away. I'm talking about leaving one church and joining another one. It's, well, he pointed to studies that have been done, a lot of big churches, and more organized churches, I guess, will do exit surveys. If somebody leaves their church to go to another one, they're asked to fill out a exit survey to let them know why. So what can we do better? Why are you? And here's the kind of things that he points to that are on most of those exit surveys. I just wasn't being fed at this church. Or the music minister would never do the songs that I like. Or they just didn't have enough programs that fit me and my family. And on it goes, and things like this. And he says this. The main reason people leave one church and fight another one is because they have an entitlement mentality rather than a servant mentality. That the church is about serving me and meeting my needs, rather than a place for me to serve and use my gifts to glorify God. And I think he might be right that, okay, the church should meet needs. And there should be some programs and some organized ways that we can not only, you know, meet our needs, but we should particularly be looking to meet the needs of people that aren't here. That's the point of reaching out and growing. But in order for that to happen, particularly in a church our size, but really this applies to any church, that everybody has to be involved in looking for ways where they can plug in and get involved in that. Indeed, ever hear anybody say, you know what they need down there at that church? They need it's usually a plan or a program or a new preacher, you know, that kind of thing. But that wording, I've heard several times what they need. They? The old story of the guy that stood up and says, you know what they need at this church? They need a chandelier. Immediately somebody else stood up and said, I'm opposed to that, I'm against that. For two reasons. Number one, we don't have anybody here that knows how to play one of them. And number two, what we really need around here is more lights. That's what we need. But in revealing the idea that church is a they, what you're saying is you need to do stuff in a better way so as to meet the needs that I have. Church is a cafeteria, and I'm not finding a chocolate pudding or whatever it is that I want, so we need to get some of that. Rainer goes on to talk about some ways that we can fix that, and I would like to share at least three of those with you as we close. First of all, he says we need to raise the bar of expectation. We need to make sure that people know that not only are we trying to meet their needs, but we expect them to try to meet ours as well. That the church has certain things that, in fact, in a class that our elders sometimes go with, the new Welcome to Denby sort of class, four-page little introduction that they do with people, that's the last section, is what we expect of you. We expect you to be here regularly. We expect you to give to the work here. We expect you to lend your gifts to help us as we serve God, those kind of things. And I think we need to make sure that everyone knows that we are a body and we need you. That we are a team and we don't need a group sitting on the bench. That we need everybody in the game and doing their part. Paul says the number one metaphor for the church in the New Testament is the body. Here's what Paul says in Ephesians 4 and verse 16. From him, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. The imagery in 1 Corinthians 12 is, okay, we're all parts of the body, but we're not all the same part. Some are a foot, some are a hand, some are an ear, some are an eye. Some are all different. But, you know, to have a body, you need all of those things. Because if you only had eyes, where would the hearing be? If you only had feet, then where would the hands be? You know, that kind of thing. And we understand that. And that's what the church is to be. And we're supposed to make that known to our folks. And maybe that's where we have fallen down. We mentioned in an earlier lesson that it is so easy for us in our Western view of church, with the model being the theater where you're all watching me and the spiritual show is up front. It's so easy to come in and sit in a seat and observe what, and then leave and not feel like you've been challenged to be part of the whole. And we need to do a better job at raising the bar of expectation. Secondly, we need to do a better job of mentoring and training others. All right, here's the deal. I don't usually try to be profound, but I came up with a saying, a wise saying, and it's worth noting because it don't happen very often. But here's what I came up with this week. Any job in the church that's worth doing is worth having an assistant. You know, sometimes some of us that are really involved, you know, we look around and nobody's there. You know, we call a work day and you look around and nobody's there or whatever it is. And you're there all the time and you take it seriously and you just throw up your hands and saying, why am I the one always doing the work? Where are all these other people? And the answer is very simple. You're doing all the work. Nobody else, they think you're going to do the work. So why should they rock that boat? That's a pretty good deal. What we need to do, no job that's worth doing is worth doing without an assistant. We should, if we're doing something for God, we should grab somebody and drag them with us so that they will be serving as well. And that when we finally wear out, there'll be somebody to take over the work. We need to do a better job as the church in training others. And the third point he makes, and you'll think I'm making it up, but he says, you got to get everyone in a small group. What the small group does, it takes us out of this setting where you're looking at the back of somebody's head, and it puts you in a circle where you're going to be missed if you're not there. You know, one of the things that in Roger's little opening study that he has us do is a point about attendance. It's really important to take have the attendance in a small group seriously. But it should be easy to do that because there's only 8 to 10 of you. You're going to be missed. And if you always sit there and never say a word, eventually we're going to catch on that you're not involved. In a big group, that becomes difficult. And so his suggestion is we need to make sure that we break, however big our church is, we need to break it down in those manageable 6 to 12 people group so that we all can be encouraged to get more a part of one another and more a part of the work. Being a deacon doesn't mean being a church officer. It means doing a job, serving, waiting tables, and then the church recognizes your work and gives you the title to go along with it. So you are an official ambassador for the church. But whether we have the title or not, the church is not going to be the church of the New Testament until each and every one of us look at ourselves as diakonos, as servants, as table waiters. We don't come to church. We're called to be the church. And that's who we are. And, you know, this is not some artificial thing where all of a sudden we've got to try to do something different. We are the body of Christ. We are the family of God. Call is for us to get involved with each other and get involved in the work. Here's the challenge for this morning. The invitation is always extended. Usually we end a lesson by having a specific invitation to people that need to be baptized or feel the need to confess sin or something like, to come forward while we sing this last song. We're going to have an invitation song this morning, but it's not going to be an invitation song to that regard. In fact, I don't want anyone to come forward. What I want you to do as we stand and sing this song is to think about the message, to think about this call. If you're not a deacon, then why not? If you're not waiting tables, then why not? If you don't have a table, if you don't have an area of service in this church, go to one of the elders today. This is the invitation part. And say, give me a table. We'll find something where we all need, and maybe something totally different that we're not involved in that you want to start. Or it may be just getting plugged into something that's already going. Or maybe plugged into one of the service groups like Five Loaves or something like that. But all of us need to have a work that we say, I'm the deacon in charge of this. That we are servants of Christ. So the call this morning is to rise up, O church.
Rise up, O church of God, have done with lesser things. Give heart and soul and mind and strength to serve the King of Kings. Rise up, O church of God, His kingdom tarries long. Bring in the day of unity and in the night of wrong. Rise up, the Lord is calling. Rise up, it is the day. Rise up and seize the moment. Rise up, family of faith. Rise up, O church of God, this church for you doth wait. Her strength unequal to her task, rise up and make her great. Lift high the cross of Christ, tread where His feet have trod. As people of the Son of Man, rise up, O Church of God. Rise up, the Lord is calling, rise up, this is the day. Rise up and seize the moment. Rise up, family of faith. Rise up, the Lord is calling. Rise up, this is the day. Rise up and seize the moment. Rise.